Welcome to the Voices of the West, hosted by Emil Franzi and dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
Hi there, welcome to Voices of the West. Looking forward to this hour. Old friend coming on, great writer, Jan Clear. Hi, Jan, how you been?
I'm fine, Emil. How are you?
Author and historian, it says here, and local. You are from, where are you living now?
I live in Oro Valley, just north of Tucson.
We'll try not to hold that part against you.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, because I live across the street from Oro Valley and plan to keep it that way.
Good.
But anyhow, you have done a whole bunch of books, and with a little bit of luck, we'll talk about a lot of them. But before I get to the first one, I just got to do the title, Never Don't Pay Attention. Great title for the life of rodeo photographer Louise Serpa. And that's her line. And when you understand what a rodeo photographer has to do, we'll get to that one in just a minute. But what I wanted to talk about was I got reminded of you when I saw that article in the Arizona Daily Star. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce her name, but I can remember that she was born in 1788. And died about 1860 and was one hell of a ranch lady. And go ahead and tell us some more about her.
Well, I will probably butcher her name also, but Eulalia Elias was part of the Elias Gonzalez family that was huge, both in northern Mexico as well as southern Arizona. And like you said, she was born in the late 1700s. So her family goes back many years, and they, of course, are still quite prominent both here in southern Arizona and in Mexico and all over the country, from what I understand. I have heard from several relatives since this article came out, some in California and in other places. So it is a big, big clan. But Eulalia was quite unique, at least people think so for her time, but I'm not sure she really was. She traveled all over this area during that time, early to mid-1800s. And quite frankly, I think most Mexican women at that time had the stamina to do exactly what Eulalia did. She was responsible for maintaining many of the properties of the Elias Gonzalez family. And so she would travel from one ranch to the other and make sure everything was working properly. She took care of the finances for each of these. She would sometimes stay several months in one of these remote areas just to make sure things were working properly. The area here in southern Arizona was the Babacomari area, and they built a little fort there. It was a three-sided fort, and they, of course, had parapets at the top so they could see anyone that was coming after them. There was still an issue with the Apaches at that time. So, they did have their problems in that way. But they ran cattle and horses probably from the Santa Rita Mountains east and had, about 130,000 acres of property around that time just in this area. So, and she was responsible for maintaining all of this and making sure it prospered, that they benefited from it. She came up here several times, as far as we know. We don't have a lot of history on her. Her brothers, one was a priest, and one also helped her maintain these properties. They thought she was a little hard-headed sometimes and a little tough to deal with, but she got the job done, and that's what really mattered. The Apaches eventually did drive them out of this region here, and they all ended up back in the Sonora area mid-1800s.
You know, something we forget about. She was born under the rule of Spain.
Absolutely.
And the Spanish were actually in charge until the 1820s. Mm-hmm. Mexico was only in charge of this piece of dirt for a brief period of time.
Correct.
After that, it went to the United States. The Spanish did a better job of both dealing with and fighting off the Apache, the Comanche, particularly the Comanche in Texas and New Mexico, than the Mexican government did, because the Mexican government was incredibly chaotic. I mean, I always said, look, you want to know the real problem? When we started off, we got Franklin and Jefferson and Washington and Madison and all those guys, and they got Santa Anna. and it was all downhill from there. So they had, they were basically unable to keep the peace. And as a net result, by the 1840s, the Apaches had pretty well run off most of the Mexican ranchers who had settled here for a long period of time. Am I pretty close?
Yes, you are. That's exactly what happened. They just kept coming after him and coming after him. And you have to look, of course, at both sides of the story. This was their land that these people were encroaching on.
You betcha.
But it did. They were successful. They drove many of them back into Mexico territory and, just claimed the area for a while, at least.
When the Mormon battalion got here, they found all kinds of wild cattle running loose all mm-hmm. over the place, and I was told that Apaches really like the flavor of the female cow better than the male.
That's interesting.
And the net result being, after a while, there weren't a whole lot of wild cattle. And there were probably some other things that killed them off, too.
Yeah.
But by that time, you had the major, really up until after the Civil War, there just wasn't a whole lot going on. If you wanted to really color this in, you'd better color it Apaches, because I think they were in charge.
I totally agree with you, and you're right. They many of these families abandoned their cattle here when they fled back to Mexico. So there was plenty of wild cattle around.
And there were little pockets like Pete Kitchen, and mm-hmm. but basically there was a few people in Tucson. Tevis's book comes to mind that were basically there weren't very many of them, and the Apache, as we all know from Cochise, actually made book with the Gringo.
Yeah.
Seeing it as a different force, and if it hadn't been for Bascom, and that's another book, okay?
Right.
I've had him on, too. Good. That's a good story
yes.
Terry Mort wrote on the Wrath of Cochise. But right. Anyway, getting back to that, what we were going to get to is, I really, before we get to your latest book, which is the one we call Never Don't Pay Attention, how many other books do you have up right now, babe?
I have four other books that were published before Never Don't Pay Attention. And through the years, I've started concentrating more on the early women of Arizona. The one before, Never Don't Pay Attention, actually has the stories of over 30 early Arizona women in it. It's called Levi's and Lace, Arizona Women Who Made History. That was a wonderful book to write. I learned so much about some of these pretty tough broads.
Yeah, they were.
In the 1800s.
Hey, they had to be. Okay.
They were. And it was just, it was a real eye-opener to me what some of these women accomplished. And it's many of these stories that I'm using now, of course, for the Arizona Daily Star column, concentrating mainly on the Southern Arizona women. But the Levi's and Lace book covers the entire territory and state during that time. So we go up into northern Arizona as well as over into Yuma and those areas. So it's a wonderful beginning of a story. If someone is interested in a particular woman, this is a great place to start. And in the back, of course, we do have the works that I used to do my research, and they can explore this particular woman even farther using the sources that are in the back of the book, which is really, really great.
Outlaw. I'm looking for the, wait a minute.
Oh, Outlaw Tales of Arizona?
Yeah, there it is.
There you go. Yes. This is actually in its second edition, which is really great.
Good for you.
Yeah, my publisher wanted to know if they could get a few more stories out of me and do a second edition. So I added three chapters to the second edition, and that's been out now for about a couple years. So that I've done very well with my outlaws, and I absolutely loved working these stories. Tough research. You know, these guys, and I say guys, but there are a couple women in the book, but they didn't want their stories out there. You can't find photographs of some of them, and to get accurate information.
Did you get John Musgrove into that one?
No, I did not.
Because there's a guy who nobody ever heard of. Well, yeah, he had 17 aliases.
Well, there you go. He might be in there for all I know.
That's a fascinating book. It was done by Karen Holiday Tanner, who was...
Oh, I know Karen Tanner. Yeah,
yeah, she wrote the book on Doc Holliday, A Family Portrait. Well, in researching that one, they tripped over John Musgrove. And John Musgrove was a fascinating character for doing here in New Mexico. He was of a later generation, died in Paraguay in 1947, and his kids are still alive. They were able to interview him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, basically he was a Butch Cassidy who made it, okay? And the deal was, apparently early on he'd pulled off a major Wells Fargo robbery in Santa Cruz County in Nogales, and gotten away with so much money that Wells Fargo won't even tell you how much. So he had cash on him, and whenever he'd get busted, he'd just post bond and move on to the next county under another name.
Excellent.
And as a net result, they traced him to 17 different names. He's wanted all over the place. I mean, he was one of the biggest badasses in the Southwest.
Well, but, you know, many of these.
But a lot of these guys did that. I mean, how many names did they have?
Absolutely.
What's Billy the Kid's real name? Hello?
Right. And these were intelligent men. You know, that's why they got away with an awful lot that they did. You know, these weren't just, you know, stupid little cowboys or anything like that.
Yeah, give me a couple more that we don't think about but that are pretty interesting in your Outlaw Tales book.
Hang
on a minute. I just looked at the clock. I need to take a break.
Okay.
Come back to Outlaw Tales.
All right.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
Well, as John Camarada always looks to say, how did we ever settle the West without bringing the French horns? With a little bit of luck, by the way, that story should appear sometime in Western Writers of America's Roundup magazine I wrote on how they used to do the movies. This audience is sort of familiar with that. How they used to do the movie, the Western movie, when Republic used to make the Three Musketeers. Remember those?
Absolutely.
Well, they wrote generic music. I'm serious. They had this deal where they had the union had pretty well got this deal. There was a 40-piece orchestra on standby in all the studios. So they had this great orchestra they could just do what they wanted to with. And a lot of these guys really lived up to it. And what they would do is they'd make the movie in about 10 days, and then the guy come in to edit it, and he'd, you know, put something up, and he'd say, okay, I need a minute and 45 seconds of chase music. And he'd go back, and there'd be some tapes there, and he'd take out chase music, and okay, that one's good. And then he'd send the guys who were doing this, the music director was a note that says, I'm running low. I'm running low on love themes. Oh, okay. And they knocked this stuff out without having any specific movie in mind for it. And the amazing part about it is if you listen to it, it's actually pretty damn good.
That's great. That's great.
So anyway, I thought that would be an interesting story. I know I sent it off to Boggs about a month or two ago, so hopefully you'll see it by the end of the year. Anyhow, back to Outlaw Tales of Arizona. Who comes to mind as, you know, we got some of the ones we really know, but some of the ones we don't know are really badasses, so pick one.
Well, I'm going to pick three.
Go ahead.
Yes. And, you know, even though I made the statement that many of these outlaws were fairly intelligent, I have to say these three were on the lower end of that scale. And that's Lafayette Grime, his brother, Cicero, and their good buddy, Curtis Hawley. And have you ever heard of the globe hanging tree that sat in the middle of town at one time? Well, two of these three ended up on that hanging tree. This was back in the late 1880s. Well, the three of them were running short of funds, and so they decided to rob a Wells Fargo shipment that was on its way through the Pinellas. And so they did shoot the lead mule, chased off the driver, and got, they think, about $5,000 in gold off the shipment. Then they didn't know how to escape, unfortunately. They did kill one individual they ran across, and then they ran across the driver and eventually killed him, too. They hid the money in the Pinellas, went back into town, went back into Globe, and actually, when the alarm went out, one of the men even joined the chase to try and find these three bandits. And one of them attended the funeral of one of the men they had killed. But they were actually only on the loose about 4 days. Lafayette Grime was a very petite man, and he was a dancer. And so when the sheriff went out and looked at the scene and he saw these very small shoe prints, he knew exactly who had perpetrated the crime. So he rounded the three of them up. The town wanted to lynch them, and they tried to hold that off. They did hold court pretty quick on them, but they did lynch two of them on the hanging tree in Globe. The Lafayette and Curtis were hung. Brother Cicero, because he didn't actually shoot either one of these two individuals, was just taken to prison. But, I mean, these guys were not real adept at what they were doing.
That would have been Gila County, right?
Yes, you're okay. Right. You're right, yeah. Or in the Pinal County, too. It could have been at one time. We'd have to
Was that before the end of before the split or
right.
Not?
Mm-hmm. and then another one you might not know too much about is a woman, actually, Cecil Cresswell. And Cecil was up in the Winslow area, and she was a cattle rustler. It was pretty much out of desperation that she was when her husband died. He left her with a plot of land just outside of Winslow, but actually no money to speak of. But she built her own house on this property. She dug a well, a watering hole for her cattle. Unfortunately, she acquired the cattle from her neighbors. And most people actually looked the other way for quite a while when Cecil would kill a cow or something, because they figured she needed the food. She had no means of income. She would go into Babbitt's General Store at that time and trade cow meat for groceries. But if she couldn't find a cow at that time, she didn't have any problem substituting burro meat, and called it fresh beef right off the range.
Ooh, that's a no-no.
Yeah, this was quite a bit later. This was in the 40s and early 1950s. And Cecil was eventually caught for what she was doing. Of course, she claimed all the cattle on her ranch. She had rebranded them, and she claimed they were hers. But, of course, then when they shaved the shoulders of the cattle, they realized that they had been rebranded.
Or where's the bill of sale?
Right. She was arrested, and they had gone out to her ranch to arrest her, and so she asked if she could go back into her house before they took her off to jail. And so they allowed her to go by herself into her house because, of course, they didn't bring a woman matron with her or anything else. And Cecil, unfortunately, was a crack shot. And as soon as she went in the house, these guys knew they had made a mistake, and they really expected she was going to pick every one of them off. So they waited, and nothing happened, and suddenly one shot rang out, and the men scrambled. You know, they just went everywhere trying to get out of her line of fire. But that was the only shot that was fired, because Cecil had killed herself rather than go to jail. So it's a sad story.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, but she did rustle the cattle, and she actually managed to acquire a few horses that way, too. But she's not as well known.
Yeah,
like Pearl Hart.
And we're talking about as late as 1950.
Yes, early 1950s. Yes, when she was caught. Yeah. So, you know, cattle rustling went on for quite a while here in Arizona.
I think it still is. No, seriously.
Very good.
I've read some pieces on cattle rustling around the country right now with the price of beef being what it is. Don't be surprised. Okay?
Very good.
All right,
yeah.
So we've got Outlaw Tales of Arizona. Then we have Amazing Girls of Arizona.
Yes, that was a very interesting book to research and write. And it's written for about age 10 to adult. And it's the stories of young girls here in Arizona, again, about mid-1800s to mid-1900s, and some of the things they accomplished or that happened to them before they were 18 years old. And there's some very, very interesting stories in here. It was difficult to get the research done on this because, of course, women really didn't think they had much to say, much less their childhoods. But we have young girls like Edith Bass, whose mother, Ada Bass, happens to actually be in my book, Levi's and Lace, because Ada was considered the first Anglo woman to raise a family at the Grand Canyon. Well, by the time Edith, who was her firstborn, was about 10 years old, she was riding up and down the canyon to gather up the horses and the mules for the tourists. Her father owned Bass Camp. William Bass was one of the first people to run a tourist camp at the Grand Canyon. So Edith was very much a part of the tourist business, and she absolutely loved the Grand Canyon. She was considered the first female wrangler at the canyon. She had a short life, unfortunately. She did marry, and she had three children, but when she was 28, she died from complications of surgery, and even the family's not sure exactly what the surgery was for, something like appendicitis or something like that, but she died from that. She absolutely loved the Grand Canyon, though. So her story's a little sad at the end, but she did make a difference up there with establishing the tourist camps at the Grand Canyon.
All right, hang on, Jan Clare. We're going to take a break. 790-2040, if anybody wants to ask this nice lady some questions about that and anything else she's been writing about in Arizona and Nevada history. We'll get to that when we come back.
The Lone Ranger. Fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver. The Lone Ranger.
Hi-Yo Silver! Away!
With his faithful Indian.
Voices of the West will be right back.
We search for a man named Jim Sonnet. And the legends folks tell may be true. Most call him gunman and killer. He's my son, who I hardly knew. I raised Jim's boy from the cradle. To the day he said to me, I have to go find my father.
Welcome back to Voices of the West.
That's how it should be.
Walter Brennan. So remember that series?
Jim's boy. I remember it.
Well, we would, because we used to pay attention to that story. Do you remember how many shows? The actual count is at one point in about 1960, when we only had the three networks and maybe an independent or two along the way, but they didn't really count. You had over 50 television westerns. And as the theme of this movie goes, and America was a better place when we had cowboys instead of lawyers. Okay.
Well, I don't know about that.
The heroes, as the heroes of our TV shows. Anyway, we were about to talk about the Nevada stories, and that's an interesting book, too. Go ahead.
Yes,
More Than Petticoats.
This is actually my first book, More Than Petticoats, Remarkable Nevada Women. And I was delighted to do this, even though I've never lived in Nevada and had to learn a lot of Nevada.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you were native to Nevada. Or
no,
what?
I'm not. And so I really learned a lot, as one of our sister states. And they, again, had some rough, tough women up in that area early on. We have a couple hard rock miners in this book, as well as women who did very well on the Comstock during that time. I'm sure some people have heard of Sarah Winnemucca, you know, who was a Paiute who really tried to improve the fate of her people, not with much success, but she talked before Congress. She did a lot to try and move her people into the 20th century, and she's considered the first Native American woman to actually have a book published. So that's always very interesting. We have one of the first woman doctors in Nevada. The Daughters of Charity were on the Comstock. They made a huge difference to some of the early orphans, and of course there were plenty of them on the Comstock during that time. We have a Chinese woman. And back then, of course, the Chinese were not thought of very well. But this woman who had six children, and her husband died quite early on, she raised these six children by growing white stringless asparagus, which was considered a delicacy in the California hotels. And she and her children would go out there and put tin cans over every one of these stalks so that they wouldn't have sun, which would keep them white and very tender. And she did quite well selling her products to the San Francisco hotels early on. So we have these, I'm not sure they've settled all of Nevada yet, but one of the later hard rock miners, Josie Pearl, was up in the Black Rock area, which is still quite desolate. And Josie became quite well known as the woman in the calico dress with a pickaxe on one shoulder and $10,000 worth of diamonds on her wrist. So she was a quite a fascinating woman at that time. They're just as interesting to me as the women in Arizona, and have as much to contribute to the history of their state too. These gals really made a big difference, you know, in the development of their territories and states.
When are you going to do New Mexico, or somebody beat you to it?
Yeah, this More Than Petticoats is a series that my publisher put out, and there is a book on every state. There's one here in Arizona, there's one in New Mexico, so they're all over. Yeah, there's one all over. It's a wonderful, wonderful series. Yes.
Super. We got a call. Let's take a call from Frank. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Emil. Hi, Ms. Clear. I really enjoyed the Outlaw Tales of Arizona. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with your newer work, but I was wondering if you've ever come across the story of Larcena Pennington. I've become familiar with that.
Yes, actually, Larcena Pennington is in my book, Levi's and Lace. I've done quite a bit of research on her. It's a fascinating story. And
yeah.
Would you like to tell it, Frank?
No, I'm really enthralled by her. Her story kind of encompasses a period of time that I'm really enthusiastic about, the pre-Civil War period in the Santa Cruz Valley.
Yeah.
And she was actually abducted kind of in my backyard.
Really? Oh, how interesting. Yes, just so people know what we're talking about, Larcena was captured by five Tonto Apache warriors up in the Santa Rita Mountains. She was up there with her husband. He was chopping down wood, and she and a young girl, 10-year-old Mercedes Sayas-Queros, were kidnapped by the Apaches. And Larcena was eventually left for dead for them. They actually stabbed her multiple times, threw her down a ravine, and left her for dead, and took off with Mercedes. And so for 2 weeks, Larcena survived on that mountain. She could not even walk because they had taken her shoes. And so she literally crawled down that mountain over a two-week period. It's an amazing story of the early women of Arizona.
Existed on snow, melt, and grass for 14
and one
days.
Raw rabbit.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And
yeah.
She used a peak down here that we often ride to, Huerfano Peak. as a landmark, and it's covered with pictographs. If you ever get a chance to go out there, it's
an
interesting area. Yeah. But the Pennington family, that's she was one of 12 children that her widower father brought to Arizona, originally en route to California in 1857. And their story really tells, it encompasses the whole pioneer period of this area.
Yes, it's a wonderful story. And actually, there's a book out on the Penningtons written by Virginia Cullen Roberts, With Their Own Blood.
Yeah,
and it really tells a wonderful story of the Penningtons. It's a good example, yes, of what people endured out here early on. Yeah.
One of my favorite anecdotes out of that book is, after the Army leaves, the bands of Apaches that had never rallied together before pretty much clean out everything from the Sonoyta Creek through the Santa Cruz Valley and chase everyone into the Presidio of Tucson. And Poston, who gives up his mining works in Tubac, his enterprise, is sitting at his desk in Tucson, and he personally enumerates everyone he knew that was killed by Apaches since he had arrived here in 1857. So this is 1857 to the summer of 1861, and he personally knows of 170 people that have been killed by Apaches. That was a quarter of the population of Tucson and southern Arizona.
It was an amazing time.
Up until after the Civil War, really, this was Apacheria. I mean, you can kind of tell by who was getting killed.
Yeah, it's, not to interrupt too much. One other fascinating wrinkle that I had never heard discussed anywhere else was and I believe the Penningtons were part of this, that everyone knows the Camp Grant massacre tragedy, but the pioneers never agreed with the Army. They insisted, and they knew a lot of these Apaches on site by name, they insisted that those were the Apaches that were raiding as far as the Sonoyta Creek. And I believe Marcina's husband, who didn't live very long after her abduction.
Just a year. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's suspected that he was killed by the same Apaches that were at Camp Grant. But anyway,
thank you, Frank, because that's an interesting piece of you got to tell the story straight. We understand why Apaches acted like Apaches, but what you need to understand is why the people who were killing Apaches acted like they did. And part of the reason was, if you hadn't been over to see your brother for about a week and you rode over the hill and found him hanging upside down over a fire and his wife gutted in the front yard and the kids nailed to the wall of the ranch, you might just have a desire to get even, I mean, it cut two ways. It's unfortunate, but it did. This wasn't just peaceful little farmers getting picked upon by terrible white people, okay?
No, you're right.
All right. Thank you, sir. Drew.
I am enjoying this immensely. This is the delight of my day.
I am delighted to hear that.
Is Joe Dreyfus, Jan. I don't know if you know him. He has his show tomorrow.
The book that you have written on Louise Serpa, I am quite interested in obtaining and reading. And there is a reason why, and a funny story that kind of tickles me. When I was a child, my dad announced the rodeos at 49ers Guest Ranch.
Hmm.
And a lot of the old-timers or cowmen, horsemen, my dad would take me over there and say, okay, well, you stay with Pop Walker or you stay with whomever during the rodeo. And I will never forget, as long as I live, I think it was the first time that Louise Serpa went out into that arena with her camera. The old man that I was sitting with and his wife, Pop Walker, who owned the stables at River and Campbell, and I'm going to quote him, "What in the hell is that damn dude woman doing out in the arena?"
Yes, she might have thought the same thing about that time. Do you know what year that was?
Sweetie, that'd been in the 50s.
No, Louise didn't start shooting until about 1963.
No, I was there. It was in. It had to been in the late 50s.
She wasn't in the late 50s. Louise lived in Oregon. She was still married at that time. She left Oregon in 59 or early 1960.
Well, what's fascinating is we have a family photograph that Louise took of my dad at 49ers during a team roping. And later on, I have several photographs of Louise's photographs of my wife when she was showing. Of course, that would have been in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But I can remember that like it was yesterday.
Oh, now, wonderful.
Whether she stayed at 49ers Guest Ranch at that time or whatever, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it'd have to be in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the reaction of all those old-timers is, you know, what is that woman doing?
Right. She got that comment several times during the years, but she held her ground. There's no question
absolutely.
About it.
No, she was a delight.
She was a
absolute delight,
person.
And I got to know her a little bit. So,
did you? Wonderful.
No, I'm interested in obtaining that book. Hopefully a signed copy that Emil will get me. Correct, Emil?
Mr. Dreyfuss, I think that could probably be arranged if you might consider having Jan do an interview on your show.
There you go, Joe.
Jan, you have an open invitation, my dear, because you're talking about Apaches, Southern Arizona, and my people were here.
All right.
During the Indian Wars. So,
well, if you're in Southern Arizona, we're actually having the launch of this book in Sonoyta on October 25th. And we're going to have quite a celebration at the fairgrounds down there, just from about 2 to 4. One of Louise's daughters is bringing down some of her memorabilia, her plastic tequila bottle, her shot glass, two of her favorite cameras. I'm going to give just a little speech on Louise, and then it's just going to be a wonderful 2 hours. We've got food, and I will definitely have books at that time, too.
And
so I think it's going to be a great
celebration. I was asked to do the drywall in her last house there.
Oh, the one on Fort Lowell?
Yes.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
And I passed on it, and she's an artist. I'm kind of glad I did pass on that one. poor contractor.
She designed her own home. She designed every inch of her home.
Well,
you know.
She was neighbors to my mother-in-law in X9, right next door.
Oh,
and
okay.
So she moved from there mm-hmm. to the house. And so, you know, I've known her over the years.
Well, that's great.
Since Harry produces your show as well as mine, Harry, I think you could just do a fast follow-through and set Jan up as a guest on Dreyfuss before the event on October 25th in Sonoyta.
Well, how about 2 weeks from tomorrow?
Well, you know what? Yes, I can't look at my calendar right now.
Yeah, work it out, guys.
Yes.
We'll work it out. But
absolutely delighted.
I absolutely appreciate what you do and what you've done, and you must be quite a researcher. And, hey, maybe we can enslave this gal to help me out on my deal there, Emil.
Oh, sure. You bet. We'll talk about
thank
it.
Thank you, Joe.
You live, give me don't give me your address, but give me an approximate. I want to see if she's living on some of my grandparents' old property there in Oro Valley.
In Oro Valley?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
my grandparents used to own what is now the Catalina State Park. So,
I'm not too far from there. That's a wonderful place. Yes.
There you go. Oh, no, yeah. This is going to be a blast. Emil, I am enjoying this immensely.
Thank you, my friend. It's always good. Now, I won't charge you anything for getting you a guest and taking care of filling on one of your shows, okay?
Well, I've got an answer to that, but we can't say it on air.
We'll do that later on. I'll see you next week, buddy.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Hang on, Jan. Rich, hang on as a caller. We're taking the last break.
Voices of the West will be right back.
At 24, he had been the youngest general in the Civil War. Within 5 years, he had been reduced in rank and sent west to be forgotten. But he was not the kind of man to let the world forget. His name, George Armstrong Custer.
Welcome back to Voices of the West.
Hi there. Welcome back. Our guest, author Jan Clear. We're talking about a whole lot of her books. Hang on, Jan. We're going to take a call from Rich. Hi, Rich. Thanks for holding on.
Okay.
You're on.
Hello?
Yes, you're up.
Oh, hey. I have heard stories about a woman, and I don't know, I forgot what her name was, because I did some research on her. And she worked for. She lived on the Tohono O'odham back in early 1900s, and she trained the natives there and stuff like that. And her husband and herself had a wagon, and they had a car, and they did a lot of stuff out there. But she had a little store out there. And I don't know if this lady that you're talking, we're talking to on the phone, on the radio now, knows anything about her. I actually visited the cemetery where her and her husband were buried out there on the nation. And it's a wrought iron fence all the way around, and it's way out there in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, I believe you're talking about Goldie Richmond.
That's who it is.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, she's quite an interesting doll. Carolyn O'Beggy Davis has written a book about her, and it's a wonderful book. Yeah, they had a little old trading post out there for many, many years, and she was very well thought of by the Tohono people, yeah.
Yeah, she taught them how to wear, they never wear anything above the waist, she taught them how, the women, how to wear things above their waist and wear shoes and dresses and taught her all the seamstress stuff and make clothes for them. The history is quite great.
That was a rough existence. Yes, that was a rough existence out there for them, and Goldie just loved it, and she loved the people out there, too.
I work out there, and I read the history books that they have out there, dating back to the 1800s about the Apache Wars and the Apache attacks and everything like that.
And by the way, the Tohono were not pussycats. They could handle. They could stand up pretty good to an Apache when a time came.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it was. I went with the Union Army against the Apaches several times. But they're pretty peaceful people all in all. So, anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rich. Good call. Appreciate it. 790-2040. We've got about 5 minutes left. I was going to get back to one fast item before we forget it, and that is the Empire Ranch Roundup on November 7th. I believe you're going to be down there with a stack of books.
I will certainly be there. I always love to come to Empire Ranch, and I will definitely be there. I will have a slew of Louise Serpa books with me because I know Louise thought highly of Empire Ranch also. So definitely, I will have all my books with me, but I'll definitely have a lot of
Well, I was going to also say we're going to try to have you indoors this time, okay?
That would be so nice. You never know what the weather's like down there.
Well, and the wind and the band's a little loud and all the rest of it. And it's good music, but you don't want to have it drowning you out.
It is, and I do like to talk to the people that come up to the table and, you know, get...
Yeah, that's half the game. And
it's hard to hear.
Yeah, we've discussed that, and we're going to rearrange some stuff and try to move the authors indoors. Anyhow, here's a question from somebody who just called it in, and that's, did you do any research on Grandma Goodman, who lived in St. David?
No. Do we know Grandma Goodman's first name?
No, nobody gave it.
Well, I'd like to know more about her.
Yeah, how about Grandma Goodman? Well, I tell you what, the guy you might want to ask, since he spent some time down there, just might be Joe Dreyfus.
So great.
When in doubt, you know, we talk about oral history, which was ignored forever. And now suddenly we've found out that, you know what? We've learned a lot from the people who bothered to write down what some of the Apache were telling them, or some of the Lakota were telling them about Custer, or the Comanche, or all the rest of the Indians who've come up with filling in a whole lot of the history. And the same holds true with some of the gringos and some of the Hispanic people, because you know what? hey, there's an awful lot there, and just because you wrote it down, don't make it so, and just because you said it without writing it down, don't make it false.
You're absolutely right.
And I am so tired of academic historians that can only say, well, the official source, yeah, right. Kind of like now?
Yeah. You're right on. Yeah.
I got 2.5 minutes, maybe a little bit more. Can I just read one thing? Anyone who has ever stared down an angry bull coming full throttle across an arena aimed right at your gut will understand why rodeo photographer Louise Serpa adamantly and often uttered the adage that became her motto, which was, never don't pay attention. I just thought that was a great line, and I had to get it in for
you. Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much. Yes, Louise, this was a 3-year project to put this together. If it hadn't been for her two daughters, it never would have happened. But they just opened up all of the material they had on Louise. They told me stories about her. There's some fascinating incidents during Louise's life that I think people will find interesting throughout the book. You'll have to look up the story about the boa constrictor and Louise and the love affair they had, and different stories like that. So I do hope it will be worthy of her. That's what I was aiming for.
That's a great way to write a biography of anybody. Thank you. And not for yourself, but for them.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I do hope so. I'm sure there's other stories out there. I'm hoping to meet people, particularly in Sonoyta and at the Empire Ranch, that knew Louise that I didn't know about when I was doing this, and get more stories about her. I would love to hear stories about her.
You know what, Jan, what I regret the most is I came here in 1957. Do you know how many people were still walking around then who went all the way back to probably damn near the Civil War?
Yeah,
And we talked to a few of them, and we got a couple of, but, you know, we didn't appreciate it. We didn't take notes. We didn't ask, and we didn't pursue. And now it's too late because they're gone.
You're right.
But hopefully we can find some stuff that they told their kids or their grandkids or whoever, and we can kind of put it back together secondhand. And a lot of the secondhand stuff's good.
Yes.
You've done that.
Yes, you do. You do your research. If you can find, I always say you can find a minimum of 3 sources of a fact, then you might actually have an actual fact, you know, but you have to do that research to get to that point.
Well, just because a government official wrote it down, don't make it so.
Exactly right.
Thank you, ma'am. Jan Clear. The books are, well, we just named about 4 of them. That's Clear, CLEERE. Go ahead and Google it, and we can find them on Amazon, can't we?
Yes, they're on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They're in the local bookstores, too.
Thank you so much, Jan.
Thanks for listening to Voices of the West.